the hero himself. The look he gave Charlie was a cross between dubious and skeptical, but at least his attention had been engaged. So Charlie said to him, "Farik, I saw you make that 70-yard run against Tulane last year, the one where you shook off 6 tacklers." Farik kept looking at him, twisting his lips and nodding his head up and down a few times, as if to say, "That's true. That happened. And so what?" Then he sprawled back even farther on the couch, his long shanks akimbo, and said to Charlie, "Tulane, they teach him to tackle head first." And then he shrugged, as if to say, "That explains that," and looked to McNutter for confirmation, which McNutter gave with enthusiastic nods of the head. His big star had at least deigned to speak to the 60-minute man of yore. Fannin turned back to Charlie, challenging, "Who'd you play against?"
"Who'd I play against?"
"That game you was talking about, where you took the ball from the quarterback."
"Georgia," said Charlie. "University of Georgia."
"But who'd they have?" said Fannin.
"Who'd they have?" said Charlie.
"Playing for 'em." "Who'd they have playing for 'em?" Out of the corner of his eye, Charlie could see both McNutter and White. Their faces were sagging with concern. "Yeah," said Fannin. "Who?"
"Well, hell," said Charlie, "I remember some of 'em. Smiley, Rudy Brower. They had this end named Goody Kuntz. I remember him."
"Uh-huh," said Fannin, "but what did they be?"
"What you mean, what?" said Charlie.
Fannin said, "How many of 'em was African-Americans?" Roger sagged back in his chair and closed his eyes. He knew exactly where this little Socratic dialogue of Farik's was heading. Why had he, Roger Too White, been so foolish as to tell Farik that all the records set by Southeastern Conference greats of long ago didn't mean but so much, because all black athletes were shut out of the competition by racial segregation? Why had he told Farik that at the very least all the records in the record books of that time should have asterisks with a footnote reading, "Black athletes," or rather, "African-American athletes"? Farik had already picked up the new nomenclature on his own. "African-American athletes denied access to conference schools." Why had he wanted Farik to know that the likes of Charlie Croker would have probably been mediocre in contemporary competition? He knew why. Oh, yes, he knew why. He had been desperate to ingratiate himself with Farik, so he would seem black as thou, so he would be treated as something other than a bitch in a suit by this egomaniacal All-American with the diamonds in his earlobes. But he never dreamed the kid would be stupid enough to use it against Croker. If he'd told the kid once, he'd told him 10 times that Croker was sympathetic to his plight, that even though he hadn't played against black athletes, he was a big star in his day and understood how people always tried to take advantage of stars like him, Farik. He'd done everything but write the kid a script of how this meeting should go. He'd told him 100 times that Croker was an old man, a bit of a throwback, part of the old white establishment, but that he could also help him a great deal for that very reason. All he, Farik, had to do was be polite and act interested. He didn't even have to be nice. All he had to do was be agreeable. And now the kid was throwing all the background information in the man's face and saying the hell with the foreground, which was his chance to get free and clear of the mess he was now in. "How many of 'em was African-Americans?"
The question rocked Charlie. He stared at Fannin for a moment with no expression at all. Then he cast a glance toward McNutter, who opened his eyes wide and pulled his mouth over to one side in the look that says, "Don't blame me, I can't control this situation." Then he cast a glance at Lawyer White, who was leaning back with his eyes closed in the look that says, "Oh, shit, I give up." Then Charlie said, in as even a tone as he could manage,
"None of 'em." "So, all them records in the record books, they ought to all have asterisks and little things saying African-American athletes excluded."
God damn, thought Roger. He even remembered the asterisks. He's throwing the whole goddamn thing into Croker's face, asterisks and all. Charlie's consternation gave way to a surge of anger.
Look, my friend, let me tell you something. I was a kid like you back then. It wasn't me who wrote the history of the South, and it wasn't me who ran Tech and the University of Georgia. I played the hand they dealt me, but I can tell you this much. I would have played against any son of a bitch they put out there on the field. I was 22, 23 years old, and I didn't give a shit. I was ready to crawl any asshole they put up in front of me. Right after that, I went off to fight in Vietnam.
Roger pressed back as far in his chair as he could go and braced for an explosion from his uncontrollable client, who had just been called, by proxy, a son of a bitch and an asshole. Instead, Farik was just staring at Croker, frozen, his lips parted. He looked as if the wind had been knocked out of him. And now, all of a sudden, Roger was afraid Croker would try to crawl Farik. So he blurted out,
"That's more or less what I was telling Farik."
"What was?" said Croker with a cross, puzzled look on his face.
"About how you were decorated during the war," said Roger to White.
"Decorations ain't the point," said Croker, whose diction was becoming more and more down-home Baker County, the angrier he became. He shot an accusing look at Farik. "You ever been in a war? You ever been in a firefight?"
"What's a firefight?" said Farik.
It took a moment for Roger to figure out that firefight meant firefight. He said hastily to Farik, "A firefight, a fight with gunfire in a war."
"No," said Farik in a surly but at least not hostile way. "I ain't been in a war. And if they tried to make me, I'd do what Muhammad Ali did. He refused to fight for the devil."
"Yeah," said Croker, still fuming. "Muhammad Ali want the first man to turn yellow in the face of gunfire."
Roger Too White closed his eyes again. He wasn't about to translate that line for the benefit of his client. The situation was degenerating too rapidly already. Croker bulled on.
"Prize fights. And football too far as that's concerned. There's nothing but chair raids for firefights."
It took Roger a moment or two to figure out that charades meant charades. He just prayed that Farik would never figure that out. He shut his eyes tighter.
"Mr. Croker, one scotch and soda."
At the sound of the woman's voice, Roger opened his eyes. Coming through the doorway was Val McNutter. She had her strange, leering smile across her face, as if this were the happiest bunch of Buck's pals who had been in the house in a long time, and they were all panting for the arrival of Venus in the flesh. She carried the tall glass of scotch and soda, as if it were a gift from the goddess. One belligerent, Croker, was suddenly neutralized, as if a switch had been flipped. The other belligerent, Farik, was speechless, all eyes.
"Thank you," said Croker in an oddly faint voice as he took the glass. "Thank you very much."
Then Val McNutter pivoted on her high-heeled pumps, and this and that and them and those went hither, thither, whither, crevice, crevasse.
"Anything I can get for any of you other gentlemen?"
Such an insinuating leer.
"No," said Roger almost meekly. "No thanks."
"No thanks, Val," said Buck McNutter in the voice of a whipped male.
Farik, drinking in this vision as if preparing for a trip across a terrible desert, just shook his head. The goddess stood motionless for a moment, turned to leave, then turned back with the most suggestive grin yet, and said,
"If you change your mind, just let me know."
Say what you want about her, thought Roger, but Madam McNutter's wiggle in her walk had just diffused a bad situation. To Roger's surprise, Madame McNutter's mate, Buck, offered the following soothing opinion as soon as his wife left the room.
"You got to admit one thing, Charlie. Some things never change. I bet you they were the same for you. They sure as hell were the same for me when I was at Ole Miss, and I know for a fact they're the same for Farik now. I'm talking about the way these little groupies come on to you if you're on a football team. Everybody talks about it as if it's something just happened yesterday."
The mighty McNutter had always been a cracker, thought Roger, but now he was trying to get right down on the same wavelength with Croker.
Body's just more the same. Now tell the truth, Charlie, ain't that the case?
Charlie looked away and sighed and took a sip of scotch and soda and said,
I suppose.
Charlie was still angry, but his more calculating self said,
This kid's an obnoxious, arrogant asshole, but you need this deal, Charlie, and McNutter's offering you a way back into it.
So he looked at McNutter and nodded, as if to say,
That's true. That's true.
Encouraged, McNutter said,
The only difference today is that the girls flaunt it so much. You know what I'm saying? When we're on the road, I practically have to keep these characters,
he smiled slightly and nodded in the direction of Fannin,
under lock and key. Because all these little cookies, these little groupies, they'll come right into the hotel lobby or wherever the hell else we're staying. They're not even subtle about it, right, Freak?
Fannin gave a couple of grudging nods, just like Charlie's. Maybe he wanted to get back in the deal, too.
And at the same time, said McNutter, anxious not to lose the momentum he seemed to have built up, at the same time that these little cookies are more aggressive about it than anybody my age or your age could even imagine, there's a lot more jailbait out there. You know what I mean? I'm not just talking about underage girls, although God knows there's them too. I'm talking about sexual harassment, sexual assault, date rape. I mean, in my day, all those terms, they didn't even exist. You either had rape or you didn't have rape. There wasn't anything in between the way they have now. Isn't that the truth, Charlie?
Charlie nodded. He nodded dourly, but with one more up and down of the chin than the last time. And another wavelet of guilt began rolling through his nervous system. Yes, the sad truth was, he wanted back in.
I mean, you get some kid 20 or 21 years old, McNutter was saying, and he's in the season of the rising sap, and he's a football player. And the college has pep rallies, whole stadiums full of students the day before the game, cheering and carrying on and telling them how wonderful they are. What's a kid that age supposed to think? It's a goddamn sexual minefield out there, Charlie.
All at once, Charlie thought of Serena. And Martha. McNutter had his own Serena, obviously. That little cupcake, who was just here, didn't come marching out of Old Miss with Buck McNutter. Maybe it was all just an inflammation, an epidemic. Maybe he shouldn't condemn this big black kid just because Inman, Elizabeth Armholster, how did he know what Elizabeth Armholster was like? As McNutter said, this was a different world put there today for kids Farik Fannin's age.
Crack!
Fannin was leaning back on the couch, his weight resting on the base of his spine and his head hanging down, busy wrapping one massive hand around the other and cracking his knuckles. His legs were spread wide apart. Charlie noticed for the first time that the canon had on a wristwatch with a massive gold band and gold rings on both hands. The hands were so huge, the cracking of the knuckles sounded like vertebrae breaking. He was so big it was hard to fit him in with any general statement about kids. McNutter was leaning forward in his chair, looking at Charlie. The coach's neck was wider than his head, and his head was so big his eyes looked like two tiny peepholes.
Farik's a great football player, Charlie, the greatest I personally ever had the pleasure of coaching. But he's a babe in the woods as far as being a celebrity's concerned.
He shot a glance toward the great lad.
I'm just telling it like it is, Farik.
Fannin hung his head down even farther and stared at his mentor through a pair of sinister, upturned eyes. McNutter said,
What examples he ever had, Charlie? I mean to deal with all this stuff. Tell Charlie about your dad, Farik.
A whispery, rumbling voice came out of the great, hung, shaved head.
Never knowed him. Never knew your own father, said McNutter in a solicitous voice.
More whispery rumble.
My mama, she pointed him out one time, but I never knowed him.
McNutter said,
Tell Charlie where you grew up. You grew up on English Avenue, isn't that right? In the Bluff?
Yeah, said Farik Fannin. His head still hung low, and he seemed to be staring through the floor.
"And your mama," said McNutter, "she looks to you as the first child she ever had, the first person in her whole life, far as that's concerned, who ever made something of himself. Isn't that true?"
"Hangdog."
"Yeah."
Suddenly he lifted his head and, eyes ablaze, said to McNutter, "And now they be messing with my endorsements." Roger Two White attempted to head off this particular lament.
"I'm sure that's the least.
Iron Man and Mars and Mishima," said an indignant Farik Fanon, running right over Roger's words. "They be bidding against each other for 3 months, and now I don't hear nothing from any of 'em ever since this girl run this game on me."
Roger closed his eyes again. Technically, Farik was still an amateur, even though amateurism in Division I intercollegiate football had become pretty much a joke. Farik was not only not supposed to be encouraging three sneaker manufacturers like Iron Man, Mars, and Mishima to bid for his endorsement when he turned pro, he wasn't even supposed to know about such things. Worse, by presenting his plight as a matter of money, he was throwing away his sentimental advantage as the put-upon boy from the ghetto who made good.
"Muffo," said Farik. "All some hubba-ho got to do is run a game on you and these bitches in suits that run these companies. They don't want to know your name no more."
Farik shook his great shaved head as if human perfidiousness had never before been pushed to such an extreme. Roger said, "But that isn't really what bothers you, is it, Farik?" Bitterly,
"No, it don't bother me. It just pisses me off totally."
McNutter said,
"A lot of girls hit on you. Come on to you. Isn't that right? Black girls, white girls, Asian girls, Hispanic girls, every kind of girl. Isn't that the truth?"
Farik wrapped his eyebrows around his nose and finally said,
"I never knowed any Asian groupies."
"But plenty of all kinds of others, right?" said McNutter.
Fannin's eyes blazed at McNutter again.
"What's these three white hubba-hoes doing at a freaknik party, excepting they want to hook up and do some juking? This girl, I never even seen her before at night. All she's doing's trying to get her own self off the hook."
Roger broke in. "We're not here to go into details, Farik. We're just here to share our experiences in general. Mr. Croker's in a unique position to understand, your position."
He was fishing for words, anything to keep Farik from saying something in Croker's presence that could be used against him, especially considering the fact that the hoped-for deal with Croker appeared to be heading straight down the toilet. Farik gave his lawyer a petulant look.
"All I'm saying is, ain't no way you can call it rape."
"Charlie," said Buck McNutter, "it's very important to Farik that he not be charged with any crime. He's never been in trouble with the law, and if you grew up in the Bluff the way he did, that's saying something. Farik, tell Mr. Croker about the boys you used to run with in the Bluff."
"What about 'em?" said Farik, genuinely nonplussed.
"Tell him where they are now."
"Oh, yeah," said Farik,
as if suddenly remembering the lines of a song.
"They's in jail, or they's dead, most of 'em."
He looked not at Charlie, but at McNutter, as if waiting for approval.
"I'm sure Mr. Croker can relate to that, Farik," said McNutter,
then to Charlie.
"I know from something I read you didn't have any picnic growing up either."
"I can relate to that. What bullshit."
Charlie was offended, but all he said was,
"Relate to that? Let's see. From the time I was born to the day I went off to the army, I knew one boy, Bobby Lee Kite, who got arrested for disturbing the peace after the usual Saturday night rock fight outside of McCrory's store up at Newton."
He gave McNutter an annoyed look and wondered if he got the irony. But then he asked himself, "Why am I bothering to be ironic? Why don't I tell these clowns what I really mean? Am I that weak? Am I that desperate to keep the deal alive?" To his surprise, Fanon turned toward him. He hadn't looked squarely at him since he entered this room, and said,
"He says,"
he motioned toward Lawyer White with his head, and it occurred to Roger that Farik had never referred to him by name,
"he says you own a plantation."
Charlie gave him a dubious look and said,
"That's right."
Roger said, "I was showing Farik the article about you in Atlanta Magazine.
I heard about 'em, said Farik Fannin, but I never seen one.
Charlie had no idea what to say to that, and so he said nothing.
Fannin said, he told me you be having these weekends down there where you invite a lot of people.
Charlie shrugged.
You know what I'd like, said Fannin. I'd like to see one. I'd like to come down there for one of those weekends.
Charlie studied him for a moment. Farik Fannin now had his arms stretched out along the ridge of the couch's backrest. He was so big his fingertips reached almost from one end of the couch to the other. Charlie was taken aback by the proposal, which came from out of nowhere, so far as he was concerned. The moment lengthened, lengthened, lengthened. Charlie said to himself, "If I'm around this son of a bitch much longer, I'm going to have to tangle with him." But what he said was, "You wouldn't like it, my friend. This isn't a good time to go to Turpentine, not when it gets hot like this."
Fannin smacked his fist into the palm of his hand, and he said with great animation,
"That's what he told me. He told me that's what it's called, Turpentine. He told me you go there and shoot quail. What do you shoot 'em with?"
"What do you shoot 'em with?"
Charlie studied the young black man's face. Was he taunting him, or what?
"You shoot 'em with shotguns."
"Shotguns."
Fannin had a strange, dreamy smile on his face.
"I'd like to try that."
"Quail season's over," said Charlie. "Only runs from Thanksgiving to the end of February. Nothing to hunt down there now but mosquitoes, gnats, horseflies, yellowflies, and privy flies."
Fannin looked to McNutter instead of Charlie, as if McNutter were the daddy in charge of what was going on here.
"I don't care. I want to go see it anyway."
Once more he motioned his head toward Lawyer White.
"Told me is just like it was 150 years ago, before the Civil War, when they still had slaves. I want to see that."
"Jesus Christ," thought Roger, his face turning hot with embarrassment. "This kid's got the discretion of a flea."
"Jesus Christ," thought Charlie. "That's all I need."
He tried to imagine it, introducing this big black oaf to Durwood as his guest of honor. Farik the Cannon Fannin sitting at the great Tupelo Wood table in the gunhouse, while Auntie Bella, Uncle Bud, and Mason get a load of his insolence. His insolence slouched back in his chair, shanks akimbo, cracking his knuckles while the help gather after dinner and sing "Just a Closer Walk with Thee." His insolence on the grand tour, pausing to appreciate the designs in scrip on the face of the plantation store. Everybody, Billy Bass, Judge Opie McCorkle, Inman, finding out, and they would find out, that he had the notorious ravager of Elizabeth Armholster as his guest of honor at Turpentine. No, it was beyond imagining. A plunge into unfathomable shame. He looked at McNutter, looked at Roger White. Maybe they would say something, get him out of this. But they just sat there as if it were a perfectly normal thing. Farik Fannin inviting himself to Turpentine. Finally, Charlie heard himself saying,
"Sorry. No way. Place is closed for the season. Couldn't open it if the King of England was coming by."
Fleetingly, it occurred to him that there was no King of England. "I'd have to bring a whole lot of people in. Don't know if I could even find 'em at this late date." All the while he thought to himself, "You're weak. You're buckling under. You're implying that if the timing were better, you would invite the son of a bitch to Turpentine." He could see Buck McNutter and Roger White casting glances at each other. Could they be thinking the same thing? He felt himself plunging helplessly into an icy lake of shame. He slapped the tops of his knees in the way that says, "That wraps it up. It's time to go." Then he stood up, with a feeble lurch, wincing at the pain of one big bone grinding against another in his knee. "I gotta go," he said. Farik Fannin said to McNutter,
"What's he saying? I get to go to the place or not?"
McNutter stood up without answering the question. Lawyer White stood up, too, And so, at last, did Farik Fanon. White said, sotto voce, to Fanon, "Come here a minute," and led him out into the hallway. Charlie started to leave, too, but McNutter held up a forefinger and said, "Oh, Charlie." Then he drew closer and said, "There's just one other thing, Charlie. We can't let this whole business become just an issue where you have a 120-pound white girl from a good family, or whatever she weighs. You can't have her saying one thing and this 225-pound black athlete from the Bluff saying another thing. And that's all it is, just some, you know, isolated sex crime complaint. We have to show there's a whole community of support for this young man, and that this support cuts across the usual lines of race and class and so forth and so on." "So you don't think he did it?" said Charlie. "Look, Charlie," said McNutter, "I can't prove anything one way or the other, but Farik's version of what happened makes sense to me, from everything I know about the way things go these days."
"And what's Farik's version?"
"Between you and me?" asked McNutter, arching his eyebrows and waiting for a reply.
"Okay, between you and me."
"Between you and me, what Farik says happened is he says the girl's at this party, and she comes on to him, and so he takes her into the bedroom. And bam, bam, thank you, ma'am, that's it. And he don't think anything more about it."
"And you believe that?" said Charlie. "Like I say, I can't swear to anything, but I can tell you this much. I wasn't kidding when I said there's girls out there coming up to these athletes all day long and shaking their little booties at 'em and saying, 'Help yourself.' And a kid's being African-American don't make any difference if he's a big enough star. And Farik's real big time so far as being a star is concerned."
Charlie studied McNutter all over again. It was the term African-American that got him. What the hell had happened to McNutter? He had always figured the guy to be a good old boy from Mississippi. And here he was, observing this new etiquette, or whatever it was.
"Now, here's the thing, Charlie," McNutter was saying. "It's really important for you to be a part of Farik's defense."
"Me?"
"Look, nobody's going to ask you to say Farik ain't guilty in this thing, because that you don't know. Just like I don't know. And nobody's even going to ask you to say anything nice about Farik. I know he's not the easiest kid in the world to get along with. Although a lot of it is that nobody ever raised him to be polite. Nobody ever taught him about everyday common courtesy. All you'd have to do would be to tell what you do know, namely, that you've been there before. You know the pressures being a football star for Tech. In a town like this, it goes crazy over the sport. You know how people try to exploit you, or whatever, however you want to put it."
Charlie was speechless. His lips were parted.
"And look at it this way," said McNutter. "You wouldn't be speaking out on behalf of Farik or even on behalf of Tech, although it would mean a lot to Tech. And I'm talking about from Welly Swindell all the way down. No, you'd be doing something for the whole city. You'd be saying, 'Whoa, slow down. Let's don't rush to any judgments here. Let's don't tear ourselves apart along racial lines.' And you know what? The whole town will applaud you. Everybody'll talk about your courage, including the Journal Constitution. You can be sure that they'll be behind you 100%.
Your very presence there, a press conference is what we're thinking of, your presence saying, 'Stay cool, let's wait for the facts, let's have open minds, let's be fair,' the press will hail your very presence as an act of leadership and courage."
"Great," said Charlie. "And what other courageous white people you think are going to show up for this?"
"Well, that's a fair question, Charlie," said McNutter, "and I'm going to answer it as candidly as I can. So far, all I know of is Herb Richman. You know, the guy who owns all the fitness centers, Definition America."
"Yeah, I know," said Charlie.
Jewish and a liberal, the phrase was by now fixed in his brain.
"But he don't really carry much weight," said McNutter.
"And what about you?" said Charlie.
"Me?"
"Yeah. Are you going to speak out for Farik?"
"Well, we've been thinking about whether I ought to or not.
I'd come across as an obviously interested party.
Uh-huh, said Charlie dubiously.
So, how about it? Said Buck McNutter.
Charlie just stood there staring at McNutter's huge head and its fussy silver-blonde hairdo here in Langhorne Epps's old mahogany-paneled study. So he was to be the lone white person speaking out on behalf of this lout.
Inman!
It was impossible. Who could he look in the face after that? Who of all the people he had entertained at Turpentine would ever come again? On the other hand, if he refused, then suppose he lost Turpentine, lost everything he had, including his house on Blackland Road, was wiped out, demolished. The result would be the same, wouldn't it? No one would come visit him then, either. All that which comprised the great Cap'n Charlie, punctured, deflated, humiliated abjectly, pitied, and not even that for very long.
Chapter 25 Starring Darwell Scruggs.
Late this particular afternoon, as usual, Charlie drove home from Croker Concourse and went in the house and headed for the library, where Jarmaine Wu always left his mail in a neat, squared-off pile on his desk, right in front of his chair. An old walnut swivel chair, upholstered in ox-blood red leather. The most comfortable chair in the house, to Charlie's way of thinking. As usual, he took off his jacket, loosened his necktie, and opened his shirt at the collar as soon as he entered the room, sat in the chair, turned on the desk lamp, leaned back, exhaled a contented sigh, and eyed his stack of mail, which was no greater and no smaller than usual. In an age of telephones, faxes, and computers, the mail seldom required any true cogitation. Fundraising requests, invitations, bills, mail-order catalogs, and there you had it. Charlie had come to look forward to this mindless interlude. Mindlessness meant not thinking about Planner's Bank, Farik Fannin, Inman Armholster, perfidy, betrayal, or financial ruin. And then he noticed a package Jarmaine had placed to the left of the stack of mail and slightly behind it. Idly he leaned forward and picked it up and sank back in the swivel chair again. No postage. Must have been delivered by a courier service. It was one of those padded manila mailers that books come in. And, indeed, the contours of what was inside looked like a book's. In the upper left-hand corner, in a typeface with a lot of bold flourishes that Charlie couldn't have begun to describe, was the legend Stone Mountain Productions, with an address in Decatur. In the lower left-hand corner was a large gold seal, almost 3 inches in diameter, bearing more fancy type, which said, Croker Concourse, A Vision of the Future. Then, in smaller letters, a Stone Mountain Production. Charlie sat upright in the chair. What the hell was this supposed to be? Croker Concourse? A Vision of the Future? He found the mailer's little opener tab and ripped it open and pulled out a video cassette. On one edge was a label in the same typeface, but smaller, saying, Croker Concourse, A Vision of the Future, a Stone Mountain production. Various possibilities came churning through his mind. His own publicity people? Had they made a promotional tape without his knowledge? Or was he always so groggy from insomnia he had forgotten? Wearily he got up from his beloved chair and limped over to the television set, a monster concealed in an old-fashioned cherry-wood cabinet the size of a closet, and inserted the tape in the VCR slot. The set immediately came to life. And Charlie limped back to his desk, withdrew a little remote control gadget from a drawer, and sank back in his chair once more. At first, no sound. Just an FBI warning about unauthorized use of this material. Never saw a promotional tape with an FBI warning, thought Charlie. And then Croker Concourse,
A Vision of the Future, and A Stone Mountain Production in bold white lettering against a black background. And then music. Just music at first, no picture. The music Charlie recognized. Boom, 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 boom. It was the same as the theme song for that movie. What was it called? 2001. That was the name of it. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Boom, 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 boom. Da-da! But wasn't that a little bombastic for a real estate video? Then came the picture. The camera seemed to be swinging across an infinite sea of green. The tops of trees were what you were looking at, a lush forest stretching on toward the horizon. And then in the distance, a tower with a dome-like top. The tower at Croker Concourse. The 2001 music continued, and as the camera drew slowly closer to the tower, a voice, a solemn baritone voice, said, "From out of the tangled trees and thickets of Cherokee County, Georgia, a land formerly devoted to hoed rows, lowing cattle, and country stores with Coca-Cola emblems at either end of the sign out front, rises." The camera now had the tower in a close-up. "One man's vision of the future, for Metro Atlanta, if not indeed Metro America." The boom-boom, da-da, music swelled up into a veritable thunder of grandiloquence. The camera was now above Croker Concourse, and showed the roofs of the mall, the hotel, the apartments, the tower, before lingering, for some unfathomable reason, over the immense blacktop of the parking area, which was practically empty. The camera lingered and lingered and lingered over all that empty asphalt. Charlie was going to have a few words with whoever approved the editing of this damn thing. Meantime, the voice was saying, "And that man is Charles Earl Croker." A stock publicity shot of Charlie filled the screen. Earl? He never used the Earl, and he had told them not to use it in publicity material. Take your eye off the ball for a couple of seconds, and these people will find some way to screw up on you every time. "And that development is Croker Concourse. Boom, 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 boom." Now the camera lingered lovingly on the tower itself, moving slowly down one side. Floor after floor. You could see clear through them. Looking through the window on this side, you could see through the window wall on the far side. Floor after floor after floor. Because there were no tenants in them. The damnable term see-through building, the name for new developments that were desperately short of tenants, popped unbidden into Charlie's brain. The solemn voice said, "And that future? A future free from leasehold obligations, and, for that matter, leases." What the hell was that supposed to mean? Suddenly, no more Croker Concourse, no more trees, no more music. Instead, a man in a gray suit sitting alone at a long plastic laminate conference table in a practically bare room. The man was smiling and looking straight into the camera as he said, "Good morning, Mr. Croker. Or good afternoon, or good evening, whatever the case may be." Him. The insolent one with the big chin. Zale, or whatever it is. What the hell was this? Charlie wanted to kill the picture with the clicker, the remote control gadget, but he was too morbidly hypnotized by what he now saw. "We've chosen this unconventional way of saying hello because our conventional attempts— I might mention innumerable telephone calls, letters, faxes, email, FedEx envelopes, and in-person requests for audiences, have produced no response. But we feel sure that you will respond to this documentary about the creation of Croker Concourse." Now Charlie recognized where this bastard was. The conference table he was sitting at was the same one they had used for the workout session. You could see the modular units that made up the table, but didn't meet truly. In the background over there was that same dying dracaena plant with the drooping yellow fronds. And visible on a side wall, one of the huge, rude, no-smoking signs. Zale's rasping, grinding voice was saying, "Our story begins 7 years ago when Charlie Croker was looking for land in the southern part of Cherokee County for a grand outer perimeter mixed-use development. To his surprise, he learned that speculators had already decided that the county had a great future, and had bought up most of the land and were willing to sit on it until the moment for high-priced development arrived. As things now stood, the land was prohibitively expensive. The acreage Charlie Croker required for a Croker concourse would have cost approximately $4 million. The sound of this man's grating voice, the cocksureness with which he tilted his great melon of a chin up whenever he wanted to make a particularly salient point, reminded Charlie all too grimly of how much this bastard had already humiliated him. Yet he couldn't turn him off. He was spellbound. What nasty surprise did his nemesis have for him this time? The nemesis continued. One day, Charlie Croker was driving slowly through a Cherokee County back road, looking for land the speculators might have missed, when he came upon a familiar figure walking along the side of the road. His name was Darwell Scruggs. Now a picture of Darwell filled the screen, but a picture from way back. It was from the high school annual. No mistaking Darwell. That thin, hollow-cheeked face, coupled with huge ears that stuck way out to here, and a nose about twice too big for his face. Back then, the annual was a homemade job. You got ping-pong pictures of yourself for everybody in the class, and you wrote each other's captions, and you pasted it all up in scrapbooks, and you made one extra, which the school kept. This man Zale was saying, Charlie Croker and Darwell Scruggs had been classmates in high school in Baker County 35 years ago. And so Croker stopped his car, greeted his old friend, and talked a bit. In high school, Darwell Scruggs had been memorable mainly because he had joined the Ku Klux Klan as a teenager and bragged about it openly. Darwell was now living in Cherokee County, where he had formed a Klan cave himself. "Aha," said Charlie Croker. The wrenching, rasping voice of this man Zale proceeded to tell the whole story of Charlie's oh-so-ingenious and oh-so-insidious scheme. There was Andre Fleet leading his placard-carrying black protesters from Atlanta through Canton, the county seat. There was Darwell Scruggs, albeit not in white raiment and pointy hood, screaming vile racial imprecations along with a pack of raggedy youths. There were television crews from around the country. And there was Frank Farr's network talk show boldly broadcast from the very main drag of Canton as a fist in the face of racism. And there was the reputation of lovely, leafy Cherokee County being dragged through the muck. And there were close-ups of deeds of transfer showing that Charlie Croker had now been able to assemble his land in this viciously slandered county for about $200,000, one-twentieth of what it would have cost before Andre Fleet and Darwell Scruggs did their duet. Then this Zale's face grew larger on the screen, and his eyes seemed to pierce Charlie's. "As far as we can tell, Mr. Croker, there is nothing illegal about any action you took. You merely manipulated public opinion. Happens every day in this free country of ours. Congratulations. The citizens of Cherokee County will no doubt marvel at your cleverness." He smiled broadly, and as the camera pulled back, opened the jacket of his suit in order to adjust his belt where it went through the belt loops on the sides. And now you could see his suspenders. Death's heads ran up and down a black road on either side. Boom, 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 boom. and the music reached its finale as the picture of that impudent gladiola faded out on the screen. Charlie felt as if he had just been kicked in the abdomen by a horse. His head and shoulders keeled forward, and he shut his eyes and slumped over. How did they know? Who could have possibly told them? There were a few people who knew he had been friendly with Andre Fleet at one time. But nobody knew about Darwell Scruggs. Nobody would see it as just a shrewd move by a developer, would they? They'd want his head. They'd want his very hide. It would be worth his life to step across the county line. Or to show up at the Piedmont Driving Club, as far as that went. Just let this tape circulate and he'd be finished. How did they know? Too late to even ask. The fact was, they knew. Slumped over like a dead man, he opened his eyes and let them pan around the room. The great man's library. By the celebrated Mr. Ronald Vine of New York. All the carved wood, the $250-a-yard fabrics, the custom-made carpet from what the hell was the name of that place in New York. He was precisely where he had dreamed of being as a young man, living in a mansion in Buckhead. The master builder of Metro Atlanta, creator of a gleaming tower named after himself, a man whose footsteps made the halls of the mighty vibrate. And how hollow it all was. It meant only that when your egomania and the defects in your character finally plunged you into ruin, your collapse would provoke more and tastier gloating. That would be it. They'd chuckle, rub their hands together, and smack their lips. And that would be the great Charlie Croker's entire legacy. What a fraud he was, sitting here in his ox-blood leather throne as if any of it were still his. Why couldn't he put an end to it all by disintegrating, by vanishing, by walking out into the woods and never coming back? Oh, sure. With his knee, he'd be lucky to walk 100 yards. Why couldn't he? Dear Lord, take me away. Take me away in the night. I go to bed and never wake up, and it's all over. But shit, never wake up? Never wake up how? I have total insomnia. I never go to sleep in the first place. Besides, just how could the Lord take him away? Via a heart attack? Or what? He was a logical enough candidate for a heart attack. He was way too heavy, and he hadn't taken care of himself when it came to diet or exercise, and his was what they call a type. What the hell kind of type was it? He had that type of personality. But if he just lay down at night and waited for God to call him across the River Jordan via coronary ischemia, he might have a long wait. Maybe he could induce a heart attack. He would start running, sprinting the way they used to sprint in training at Tech, and his heart couldn't take it. But neither could his knee. Jesus Christ, he could see it now. He's running like hell in order to kill himself, and he has to discontinue killing himself because his knee hurts. Reminded him of the story he had read somewhere of the man who decided to kill himself by swimming out to sea until he was utterly exhausted and then would have no choice but to sink and drown. So he starts out, and all of 15 yards from shore he runs into a flotilla of stinging nettles and can't stand it and turns back. Well, why not the sea? And in that moment he understood for the first time the death of Robert Maxwell, whose body had been found in the sea near where his yacht was moored. No one had ever been able to figure it out, but now Charlie knew. Maxwell had faced bankruptcy, humiliation, and likely as not a prison sentence. So he climbed over the railing of the yacht one night and hung from the edge of the deck by his fingertips. He hung on until he couldn't hang on any more. He hung on until his immense weight, almost 300 pounds, began to tear the muscles of his shoulders and his upper back.
Then he let loose and hit the water and swallowed the ocean and drowned. The torn muscles made it look as if he had slipped overboard and had struggled mightily to clamber back to safety. That way he didn't let the bastards have the satisfaction of knowing he had taken his own life. But he, Charlie, didn't have a yacht. Maybe a shotgun. He handled shotguns all the time, and a shotgun could blow you away at short range. Fontaine Perry had owned a big plantation near Thomasville, and one day he was out hunting wild turkey. So he winged one, and the bird led him on one of those wild chases through the underbrush, such as only turkeys can do. Fontaine is plunging down a slope after the turkey, and he stumbles, and a vine rips the shotgun out of his hands and twists it about so that he falls on the muzzle, and the gun discharges right into his belly. You don't survive a load of buckshot in your intestines, and the accident would be easy enough to simulate. But Jesus Christ, how Fontaine suffered! Hung on for 3 days, in mortal agony. And suppose, through some miracle, you didn't die, and you had to live as a cripple with a colostomy bag, and you still had all your problems, and all the vultures were still circling. There had to be some way to do it the way Maxwell did it. What was he thinking? Christ, why didn't he just put the shotgun in his mouth and be done with it? But then he would be right back where he started. The bastards would gloat. And who was supposed to have the nice surprise of coming upon your body with your head exploded like a melon and your brains all over the wallpaper? So there really was only one hope. It would be hard to look Inman in the eye afterward. It would be hard to look anybody in the eye afterward. But they'd get over it. He, Charlie, would call it saving the city at a critical moment. Maybe he'd call Inman ahead of time and tell him what he was going to do. And Inman would understand. Oh, yeah, tell me another one. But this was his only hope, and maybe it would be good for the city in the long run. Stop kidding yourself.
He swiveled toward the credenza by his desk and picked up the telephone book, which had been outfitted with a stiff ox-blood leather cover Ronald got from someplace in New York, Anthony's or something like that, and looked for the number.
Ringer, Fleeceham and Tick, Ringer, Fleeceham and Tick, Ringer, Fleeceham and Tick. Here it was. Well, here goes. Christ. He didn't know whether he wanted that son of a bitch with the British clothes to still be at the office or not. He picked up the receiver and punched in the numbers. At that very moment, it so happened, Conrad Hensley was making a telephone call of his own. He had walked over to Asian Square on the Buford Highway and gone into a Cambodian bank and had $10 of his remaining stash of cash changed into rolls of quarters, which he put into his overnight bag. What time was it in California? About 3:30. That should be about right. He went to a telephone booth near the Vietnamese music store, punched in the numbers, and started pumping in quarters when the automated voice told him to. 3 rings, 4 rings, 5 rings. Damn. Would he be up and out already? 6 rings. And then someone picked up. Hello. The fact that this consummate Okie pronounced even hello on the first syllable blipped through Conrad's mind, but all he said was, Kenny? Yeah? This is Conrad. A pause, then,
I'll be damned! Crash and burn! Where are you?
Nah, don't tell me where. I don't even want to know. A couple neckties came by here last week asking if I knew where you were. Neckties? FBI. A wave of neural alarm went through Conrad's solar plexus. The FBI, are you sure? His voice was suddenly hoarse. That's what they said. I can't think of why anybody'd fake it. Where was this? Here. My house.
What did they want?
They wanted to know if I knew where you're at.
So don't tell me.
How did they connect you with me?
I don't know. Maybe somebody at the freezer. Maybe somebody you know.
What did you tell them?
I told them the truth. I said I hadn't seen you since the night you got laid off. I said didn't even know you'd been in jail until I saw it on the TV after the earthquake.
Kenny's, I told them the truth, made Conrad wary.
You think they might be bugging your telephone?
I doubt it. I mean, shit, this is a fucking nickel-and-dime case except for the fact that you're the only one at Santa Rita still unaccounted for. But you never know. So you might as well be careful what you say.
Look, Kenny, the last thing in the world I want is for you to get in any trouble over me.
Fuck it! Crash and burn, old buddy!
Sooner or later they'll hang me from the necktie on the bald man the same way they did you. All the same, I wouldn't want it to be because of me.
Fuck it, old buddy. You can't spend your whole fucking life cringing.
How much has there been on television about... He started to say me, but changed his mind. All this.
Kenny laughed. Oh, man, for 6 or 7 days there, I'm telling you, you were a media celebrity. My old buddy. I never knew you were such an evil son of a bitch. They said you were in Santa Rita for aggravated assault, for beating up a repair shop employee and causing him to suffer a nearly fatal heart attack. There you were, in a mugshot, my old buddy, the only ice humper in the whole suicidal freezer unit who still had his head on straight enough to wrestle 80-pound blocks of ice and worry about his wife and kids at the same time. I had to fucking laugh.
Did they say I'd escaped or what?
Well, let me see. At first there must have been 20 or 30 inmates unaccounted for. They were going through the rubble and every other goddamn thing. I mean, Santa Rita was like wiped out. Pretty soon they'd found or captured all but 9, I think it was, and that was when they started showing the mugshots. There you were. You were the only white man in the lineup. I think there was one Chinese guy with these big eyeglasses. The rest of them, they were East Oakland all the way. Then they caught 3 of them hiding out in Pleasanton. Man, how 3 Oakland homeboys could hide out for 2 days in Pleasanton, I don't fucking know, but that's what they did. Then they caught the Chinaman in Martinez and 4 homeboys in Oakland. So, that left you. You were the star, man. I mean, I about...
A mechanical voice interrupted and asked for more money. Conrad pumped in more quarters.
"Like I was saying," said Kenny, "I about cracked up. If I'd have had a pick out the last ice humper at Kroger Global Foods who was going to end up as an underworld escape artist, it'd have been you, bro. Man, we talked about you in the freezer for must have been 3 weeks straight."
What did the guys think?
"We were proud of you, Conrad. One of our mates had done it. We were rooting for you. We're still rooting for you."
"God," said Conrad. "Well, tell our friend in Oakland she's great. Everything's worked out just the way she said it would. Her people were the best. Straight shooters. And tell the guy who introduced me to her he's great, too. Without the assets he gave me, I couldn't have made it."
"You in the place she was talking about now?"
"Yeah. I'll move soon, but everything's fine. Soon as I get work, I'm going to pay that guy back."
"Ah, forget about it, Conrad. I don't think the guy's lost any sleep over it. Crash and burn!"
"Kenny, were you able to reach Jill?"
"Yeah. I called her as soon as possible. I told her everything I figured she'd need to know."
"Did she seem to know who you were?"
"I guess so. I think she said you'd mentioned me."
"What did she say? How did she take it?"
"She didn't say much. I think she was so surprised she didn't know what to say. I remember she said, 'Is he coming home?'"
"So what did you say?"
"I said to her, 'Probably not right away.'"
Did she say anything about the kids?
Nah, but you gotta remember it was a pretty short conversation.
Listen, Kenny, just one other thing. If you can, call her again. Just tell her I'm okay, and I am gonna come home when things are a little better. Tell her I think of her and Carl and Christy all the time. But you want to know something, Kenny? I can't even remember what my kids look like. In my mind, it's like the sun's gone down and it's twilight, and all I can see is these two dim, blurred little children.
Well, don't let me get started on all the things.
He didn't finish the sentence. But one thing I've got to tell you. I used to think about you guys, you and Lightbulb and Herbie Honda and Dom and Nick Necktie and Tony when I was in Santa Rita. You remember how we used to hump product for Santa Rita?
Oh, yeah, said Kenny. Nobody was sorry when the quake demolished that fucking place. I used to hate those orders. Remember all those 80-pound cartons of frozen chicken parts?
Oh, yeah.
Well, at Santa Rita, we used to practically live on pancakes and chicken. Every time a trustee passed a paper plate with a chicken leg through a porthole in the door of the cell, I could feel it all over again. What it felt like squatting down in the upper bin of Row W, Slot 9, and humping one of those 80-pound blocks of ice.
You know, Conrad, said Kenny, this may sound crazy, but I envy you.
I'm not kidding. At least you're out there, living. I'm always talking about crashing and burning, but all I'm really doing is humping blocks of ice all night. What you're doing is cool, no matter how it turns out.
Conrad said, You were right the first time. You sound crazy. One thing I can tell you, being down in Santa Rita was not cool.
At least nothing, Kenny. Santa Rita was a lunatic asylum where you live like an animal in the wild, except that all the animals are cooped up in the same pod. Half of them are literally lunatics. They're sitting around in their cells moaning, Meds! 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 That's what they call medicine. Meds. These guys are so far gone they need pills all day just to cool off enough to make it to lights out. And then they scream and moan all night.
What you need isn't something cool. What you need is a plan. You need to look down the road 5 years and say to yourself.
Kenny broke in. Hey! You're your old self, Conrad. You're still looking down my road for me. I was afraid all this shit had fucked you up. But you're normal. You're my old buddy.
All the way back to Meadowlark Terrace, the smile stayed on Conrad's face.
Gladys?
Only after he said it did it occur to Roger that he had never called her by her first name before. But he was too excited to worry about that now. His left hand, which held the receiver, was shaking so badly he could feel it rocking on his ear. Nerves. But a good case of nerves.
Yes, said Gladys Caesar.
This is Roger White. I'd like to speak to the mayor. I think this is one call he'll want to take.
Oh, hi, Mr. White. Let me see if I can get him.
In due course.
Brother Roger?
Brother Wes, we're in business. I just got a call from our friend the 60-Minute Man. He'll do it.
Way to go, Brother Roger. That's great. You're a mighty warrior.
Now, what was his mood?
He sounded awful, if you want to know the truth. He sounded mighty low.
Roger said it in a put-on basso profundo.
But he hasn't forgotten how to bargain. He said the deal isn't on until we prove that we can get Planner's Bank off his case.
Well, it's too late to do anything today, but I can make a phone call in the morning.
You're sure he'll do what we say?
Positive, Wes. The press conference, everything.
Great, great, great.
I'm not just saying this, Roger. You've done this city a great service.
Thanks.
Roger hung up the telephone and gazed out over South Atlanta from his high perch at Ringer Fleesum on Peachtree Street. Without even knowing he was doing it,
He inhaled and expanded his chest. The mighty warrior, fresh from the fray. Chapter 26 Holding Hands. How could Harry accept it so nonchalantly? Was this some kind of practical joke? Was Jack Shelnut suddenly going to pop in from out in the corridor and say, "Just kidding, Ray!" Peep gas actually flicked a glance toward Harry's interior glass wall, which looked out upon the corridor. Meantime, Harry continued to lounge back in the chair behind his desk, with his hands interlaced behind his head, and his elbows sticking out on either side, and the skulls and crossbones on his suspenders parading up and down his chesty torso. There was no way peep gas could have struck a relaxed pose like that, even if his desk chair had had leather upholstery as plush and creamy smooth as Harry's, which looked edible. He wasn't that good an actor. "What did he mean, lay off Crooker for now?" said Peep Gas, who was standing on the other side of Harry's desk and lifting both hands in front of him, palms up, in the gesture that says, "Give me a break! That's incredible!" Aloud, "What did he give as a reason?" Harry, still totally at ease, said in his rasping voice, "I'm sure you know Pliers by now. He's a courier. He's not a great one for explanations." On the organizational chart, Morgan Pliers was a vice president. In point of fact, he was Arthur Lomprey's aide-de-camp and frequently relayed the maximum leader's instructions. "He said it was a macro decision." "A macro decision?" said Peep Gas. "What's that supposed to mean?"
"You never heard Arthur talk about macro decisions," said Harry. "That means it doesn't have anything to do with the specific issue at hand. It's part of some larger strategy."
Peep Gas shook his head. "I'd sure like to know what larger strategy he's talking about, unless from now on we're supposed to let the shitheads take their sweet time paying us back in the hope that our kindness will stir them to dig deeper." Harry smiled.
"Ray, you really get worked up over this Crooker case, don't you? We may have to conscript you into the workout department. That's what we need here, guys like you and Shelnut who see traitor branded on the brow of every shithead."
"Not every shithead, Harry. But Crooker has lied, cheated, stolen, stalled us, laughed at us, played us for suckers. This particular shithead thinks he's too big to play by the rules."
"I don't think he's been feeling all that big, not since we took his G5 away from him," said Harry.
"Well, that may be.
What's Arthur mean, lay off for now? How long is for now?"
"Pliers didn't say," said Harry.
"Between you and me, I doubt that Arthur lets him in on the answer to most of these things."
Peep Gas just stood there, speechless, incredulous. He couldn't believe Lomprey could have actually issued such an order. He couldn't believe Crooker was off the hook, regardless of what "for now" meant. And he couldn't believe Harry, he who maintained he liked to see the cinders dance, could take it with such equanimity. Peep Gas could already look two steps ahead. If "for now" dragged on very long, his whole campaign to squeeze Crooker into handing over his properties would lose its momentum. Crooker might get his brute aggressiveness back. And how long could he, Peep Gas, let "for now" go on without informing Herb Richman and the other members of the syndicate about it? Harry continued to sit reared back, with his elbows winged up in the air. He was beginning to look at Peep Gas the way you'd look at a curiosity. Peep Gas said, "Well, I'm going to go talk to Arthur about it. This thing is too important to just let slide like this."
"Good luck," said Harry, with a dubious arching of his eyebrows. "But it's been my experience that when Arthur sends Pliers out with one of his macro decisions, it's something he's not dying to discuss."
It was late afternoon by the time Arthur Lomprey finally deigned to see Peep Gas. Lomprey's office was on a corner from which you could look north toward Buckhead, east toward Decatur, and south toward downtown.
and, assuming you wanted to, the vague expanse of the lower half of the city. Lomprey's office was so big, it had three seating areas, around a couch, around a table, and around his own gigantic desk. The decorators had been hard at work in here, with all sorts of leathers, fruitwoods, geometric carpeting, and fabrics that looked as lugubriously grand as old tapestries. Lomprey, seated at his desk with his head jutting forward like a dog's, looked up as Peepgas entered, but he didn't rise.
"Come in, Ray," he said pleasantly enough.
But as Peepgas came walking toward him across the great expanse of carpet, which looked oddly like rows of campaign ribbons, the little eyes in the maximum leader's jutting head returned to some reading matter on his desk. Why should he waste valuable time waiting for a mere Raymond Peepgas to traverse 20 or 30 feet of carpet? Peepgas knew then, if not before, that whatever he could do to euchre Planner's Bank out of Croker's remains was justified. In due course, Lomprey looked up again and gestured toward an armchair and said, "Sit down." Then he leaned forward and put both elbows on top of his desk, and began drumming his left palm with a gold ballpoint pen he held between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand, and eyed Peepgas with a smile that was hard to interpret. It was a smile either of amusement, over his underling's puzzlement, or of wonder, at this ant's insistence on seeing the maximum leader face to face. In any event, it wasn't friendly.
"So, what's on your mind, Ray?"
Lomprey beamed once more, and Peepgas now had it figured out. It was a smile of simple contempt. "Charlie Croker's on my mind, Arthur," he said so forcefully, in such an un-Peepgas manner, that Lomprey's smile faded quickly. "Harry tells me you want us to put everything on hold where Croker is concerned."
"That's correct," said Lomprey.
Peepgas waited for some amplification, but all he got was a renewed smile. This one had little twists of irritation in the corners. Peepgas said, "Well, Arthur, I hope it wouldn't be out of place for me to ask why. I mean, we have that particular shithead right where we want him. We've got him right on the edge of handing over everything he's got, deeds in lieu of foreclosure. But if we let up now, he's liable to dig his heels in. Dragging this thing out is so unnecessary." The smile, patient and irritated.
"I'm surprised Harry didn't explain it to you. This is a macro decision, Ray. It has to do with matters over and above what we do in the short term with the Croker workout."
In the conversational vacuum that followed, nothing more than the smile.
Did he dare prod the maximum leader further? Such irritation and contempt were in that smile. But given what was at stake, he dared. "Do you mind if I ask you what matters, Arthur?"
"I mind," snapped Lomprey, lowering his head still farther and eyeing Peepgas carnivorously.
"I hope it won't astonish you unduly to know that I am from time to time called upon to deal with problems broader in scope than what you and Harry would like to do with Charlie Croker."
"Oh, I know," said Peepgas, backing down as quickly as he could. "I realize that. It's just that here we have such a large asset in question, and a workout that's matured to such a point." He kept searching Lomprey's face, hoping for some glimmer of fellow feeling, and found none. "I completely understand. I completely understand. I just wanted to make sure all the parameters..." He never could remember what one did with parameters. He retreated from Lomprey's office in a daze. On the program of the Atlanta Symphony at the Woodruff Arts Center that evening were Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1, Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastorale, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, none of which had anything to do with the obvious excitement in the lobby of Symphony Hall. The ordinary buzz of the hive had reached the threshold of a roar. Such looks these concert-goers gave one another. Such high beams they flicked on. How they showed their teeth when they smiled.
and on all sides, on the crests of the waves of sound, Martha and Peepgas could hear the same names. Armholster, Inman, Elizabeth, Fannin, Farik, Farik the Cannon. Martha and Peepgas had been talking about precisely the same thing on the way down from Buckhead in Peepgas's rented Volvo 960. To Peepgas, even though he understood Inman Armholster's eminence in the scheme of things in Atlanta, it was no more than any other piece of lush gossip. Martha took it far more personally. Ellen. It was Ellen Armholster she kept thinking about. Imagine being in her place. The fact that Ellen had treated her like a non-person ever since her divorce from Charlie made no difference. Poor Ellen. Martha had very little appetite for talk of other people's misfortunes, and yet she felt rooted to this spot, here in the lobby, where all the frenzied talk was.
Martha!
A beaming woman had materialized before her, a 40-ish woman with the usual pineapple blonde Palm Beach crash helmet. Mariah, pronounced the southern way, Mariah Bunting. She flicked a glance, and Martha noticed it, at Ray Peepgas before she embraced Martha and swung her head past hers in a social kiss.
"Mariah, I'd like for you to meet Ray Peepgas. Ray, this is Mariah Bunting." "Hello, Ray."